Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Hello and welcome to the October edition of Wireless, a series all about radio broadcast on Flirt FM 101.3 in Galway and on flirtfm.ie. The programme is also now available as a podcast on several platforms. I'm John Walsh and I'll be with you for the next hour. Wireless covers all aspects of radio, analogue and digital, community, regional and national broadcasters, niche broadcasting, pirate radio, podcasting, radio ownership and radio's history and future prospects. Coming up on this edition of Wireless: RTE's funding crisis and how it threatens the current model of public service radio. Change is afoot in the Dublin pirate radio scene. Two important radio anniversaries in Cork and Wicklow, and research on Indigenous community radio in the US.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
But first, the news that RTE Lyric FM is possibly to face the axe as part of a new RTE funding crisis, which is unprecedented in its scale, according to Director General Dee Forbes. There's been inevitable public attention on the high salaries paid to some of the broadcasters in Donnybrook, but I think that this ignores fundamental questions about the future funding of public service broadcasting and the role of radio in that, and that's what we want to look at today. This is the fourth consecutive year of an operating deficit by RTE. The organisation reported a net deficit of €13 million in 2018. The closure of Lyric FM was mentioned as a possibility in a primetime special on the funding crisis, and it led to an outpouring of support on social media from Lyric FM listeners. So we wanted to look at some of the background to this issue and what could be done in terms of the funding crisis and the future of public service broadcasting. So I spoke to Dr. Harry Brown, Senior Lecturer in the School of Media in the Technological University of Dublin, and asked him to give his reaction to the possible closure of Lyric FM.
Well, I think it would be a great misfortune if Lyric FM were to be cut. At the same time, I think that Lyric has had a little bit of this an identity problem for some of the reasons that public service broadcasting in general has an identity problem, because it wants to be kind of high culture without being difficult. It wants to be pitching to a relatively niche audience, but it does so in a kind of a rather slick and commercial sounding fashion, in a way. You know, it's, as people would say, it's kind of somewhere between a classic FM and a BBC Radio 3 version of what a station like that should sound like. I love listening to it at times, and then at other times I find it to be a little too smooth for my liking. So I think that it would be a shame to see it go, but it raises larger questions about what is the niche for any public service, any public service that is aimed at only a minority of the audience, unlike, for instance, Radio 1 or the television stations, the main television stations.
So how does one put forward an argument in the current media revolution that we're living for maintaining these niche services as public service broadcasters? How is that argument made?
Well, I think that it needs to be made in the context of a larger argument that sees public service broadcasting and public service media more broadly, because, of course, RTE is now one of the major providers of online information that we have in Ireland, that we need to see public service media in a less centralized and more diversified form. In other words, that there are a number of ways and a number of jobs that public service media can do without necessarily doing them through the structure, through the auspices of, one giant company, essentially a state-owned company that provides all those services. There may be ways to spread around the concept of public service without it, without using public service money to subsidize commercial services, as sometimes happens through these kind of small schemes that fund a documentary here or a series there on commercial services. I think that that we need to think about ways of supporting not-for-profit media that are not necessarily RTE or RTE-owned services.
And how would you see that as happening? I mean, would that be some sort of core funding for not-for-profit media? I mean, one thing facing community radio, one challenge that we face in a community radio as a sector is the lack of any dedicated core funding and some stations existing on absolute shoestrings.
Absolutely. And that is, I think that community media, community radio, should actually be putting itself forward and being put forward as a model in this regard, as the space in which there can be centralized funding for decentralized public service broadcasting. Community radio properly funded with a substantial and guaranteed core funding could and should be in a position to build audiences, to build trust, and to build different media provision from what the commercial provision does. And I think that the fact that community radio is starved and kept on a shoestring in the way that it is not an accident. It's largely because of the extent to which commercial radio wants to keep it that way. And commercial radio has quite a significant political pull in this state since it was founded. And, you know, it was founded essentially with political pull back in the 1980s, local commercial radio, and national indeed. And that, I think, is one of the things that keeps community radio down.
And what about the RTE funding crisis then, to look at that in a more general sense? Would you see that the you know, it's not simply a question of pumping more money into RTE, it's in fact looking at a far, far broader model, a more diverse model of public service broadcasting, but how would that go down in Donnybrook?
Yeah, that would be a tough one, all right, and it is very difficult because in many respects, you know, RTE is a problem. It's overly centralized, it's very conservative, it provides a number of services that it doesn't especially need to from a public service standpoint, that services like 2FM, or like a great deal of what's on RTE television, because it needs to make money commercially, so it has this dual funding model. Yet at the same time, it is absolutely essential. I know I recently was involved in a piece of research on special educational needs and the problems for children and with disabilities and their families in the school system. RTE's coverage of that, both our own research and of the larger issues that it brought up, is unparalleled. There's no one else doing the kind of in-depth reporting on this as, for instance, Emma O'Kelly in the newsroom is doing, or that Primetime has been doing on these issues. Really powerful and informed journalism. I don't always agree with it or with the conclusions that it points to, but there's no doubt that without RTE, that doesn't get the same kind of coverage. It gets either exploitative coverage or it gets shallow coverage, or both. I mean, it's certainly possible to do both. So I think that there needs to be a way of demanding a more diverse and decentralized public service provision, while at the same time defending the public service broadcaster that we have, which is by far the best broadcaster that we have.
So it's a difficult balancing act because, I mean, obviously, if you core fund community radio, for instance, you wouldn't necessarily guarantee that standard of investigative journalism that only an organization like RTE arguably can deliver.
I think that's right. Even a well-funded community radio is not going to be able to pay a journalist to work for a month on a story that might produce a 10-minute report. You know, that's just not realistic. So, but, you know, in the, you know, I think we've figured out in the 21st century, in the, if you like, in the online media world, that it takes all shapes and sizes, that sometimes a story breaks on a, you know, on a blog, and sometimes a story breaks on the New York Times, and they can be equally valuable. And the enthusiasm and the, you know, genuine passion for issues that, if you like, the amateur or the semi-pro, you know, broadcaster stroke blogger can bring, is as important in the contemporary media environment as the professionalism and dedication that the centralized, well-resourced broadcaster can bring. I mean, but the problem is, I mean, even in online media, there's been a certain squeezing out of those minority voices, if you like, that, you know, blogging is not as important as it was even 5 or 10 years ago. And we have a situation where essentially the things that Facebook wants us to see is essentially what we get to see. The things that Google rewards with views are essentially the large commercial players again.
So to come back to the RTE question then, looking at the suite of services, I mean, you know, the television offerings, the, you know, RTE 2 as well as RTE 1, and perhaps the elephant in the room in terms of radio, you mentioned it earlier, the question of 2FM. I mean, surely 2FM is replicating or duplicating what other radio stations are doing, very many of them around the country, and if any cuts were to be made, would it not be easier to justify 2FM?
Yeah, of course, easier to justify, but at the same time, and I haven't looked at the bottom line lately, but I assume that RTE's argument would be that 2FM actually subsidizes primetime, you know, in effect, although I imagine primetime actually does pretty well in its own regard, the slot that it holds, but that the notionally, at least, that the fact that 2FM operates primarily on a commercial model doesn't really drain resources, if you like, from the, to use that terrible phrase, from the license fee, and that, in fact, you know, puts money back into RTE that it can use to fund sort of, if you like, core public service provision, that would be the defense of maintaining a service like 2FM. I don't think that is a defense, I think it's in effect a defensive position. And I think that public service provision in general, RTE in particular, but, you know, community radio and new models of public service provision need to be on the offense about what is missing from commercial media and what public service media has to provide if it's going to play any kind of a role in it, you know, in helping to keep important information flowing in a decent society.
And is the TV license fee and the high levels of evasion, is that simply a red herring here, Harry, or is there any chance of any progress on a public broadcasting levy or charge that would be applied universally?
Well, it's extraordinary, really, John, the extent to which that that red herring keeps getting tossed around, and the apparent political difficulty in making the transition from the TV license fee with all of its loopholes in the current environment and a levy that essentially was attached to everyone. I have problems with any kind of, if you like, uniform form of taxation as the TV license is, you know, one that taxes people regardless of their wealth or income. But insofar as we have a charge like that, and the TV license fee has been seen as a politically acceptable charge for the decades that it's been in place, I think that the fact that there's a difficulty about transitioning to a public service levy is just, I think, indicative of what a political hot potato this area is.
And that was Dr. Harry Brown, a senior lecturer in the School of Media at the Technological University of Dublin, speaking about the possible future of RTE radio services in the context of the funding crisis. And there's more information about Harry's research available on his website, criticalmedialiteracy.org. And I'd like also to mention an upcoming relevant conference called Emerging Technologies, Social Media and the Politics of the Algorithm, which will be held in the Technological University of Dublin City Campus in Ainger Street in Dublin on October the 18th and 19th. And more information available on that website, criticalmedialiteracy.org.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
The long-suffering RTE longwave service on 252 kHz could also be a casualty of the funding crisis, of course. The transmitter is currently off the air for major maintenance. It may be secure for now, given that RTE has committed to continuing the service for at least another 2 years. However, I don't think we can talk about any long-term certainty, given the recent funding crisis. We've covered this topic a few times before on Wireless. We've spoken to activists in Ireland and the UK who want to maintain the longwave service for the diaspora. The service was also the subject of a paper recently at the European Communication Research and Education Association conference in Siena in Italy. The speaker was Dr. Dáithí McMahon, a senior lecturer in media and cultural studies at the University of Derby. And here's an extract now from his presentation.
Okay, and of course we do know there are plenty of other ways to listen to or consume radio. You know, we know that there are millions of options. There are many other options, so you can get the mobile apps. And RTE is part of the Irish Radio Player app, which has all the radio stations on it, even some the digital stations and some that are, yes, and they're only digital, they don't have broadcast platforms. So you can web stream, of course, through your TV subscription. So I've Virgin TV connection, and I've got RTE Radio 1 and Radio na Gaeltachta, the Irish language station, I think. RT Lyric FM, you know, on the channels, on, so I can listen through my television and other people can as well. Of course, you can, you know, podcast it as well, and then you can ask Alexa to play it as well if you've got a smart speaker. So yes, we do have plenty of other ways of listening, but that, again, that kind of misses the point. When you go to demonstrations like this in Manchester in the 2017 on St. Patrick's celebration, the Save the Wave campaign was launched around then. So this is in Manchester, and you could see, like, even though there's a lot of the, again, digital platforms, you say, well, just, you can listen, there's so many ways to listen, you know, move on, you know, get with the digital times. You know, if you look at the people in these photographs, they're not going to be as techno-savvy, and they've had this problem for all of their lives, this long-wave service, you know, and it means a lot to them. And then you could see by their placards, you know, the strong themes that have come through from them, and, you know, so Save the Wave, they call it their lifeline. You know, it's quite a emotive thing, that their lifeline is in. If they didn't have that, they would feel very disconnected or lost, or, you know, they would struggle deeply without it. Our heart is another one there. Our connection with home, I mean, that's quite a strong one here. And then you can see people from all different counties, all different corners of Ireland, represented there. RTE Show You Care, Keep Longwave 252 on the air. That's good, it has a good rhyme to it. So yeah, you can see what we're saying. Those are the sentiments that have come out, and that's what rings true with the research that's been done. But yes, you can see the older demographic is quite clear as well.
Dáithí McMahon, Senior Lecturer in Media and Cultural Studies at the University of Derby, speaking recently at a conference about radio in Siena in Italy. We thank Brian Green for that audio, and we'll be speaking to Dáithí McMahon in the November edition of Wireless.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
We're interested in radio and languages on this programme, and indeed last month we featured the Belfast Irish language station Radio Fáilte. Also at the radio conference in Siena, Italy, Brian Green spoke to Jana Wilbricht of the University of Michigan, whose research is focused on community radio among indigenous Native American reservations in the US. And here's that interview now.
Yeah, so I study indigenous community media, community radio in particular, and I'm interested in how indigenous community radio is different from other community radio. So as an academic, what can we learn theoretically about how radio functions, what it provides to these communities, because indigenous peoples are different from any other community, for example, in, you know, not just their history, but they have collective rights, and so there's a different legal environment, and so it changes their functioning. I'm interested in the history of indigenous radio, which came straight out of indigenous activism, so I think there's a particularly interesting history there from a media studies perspective, and I'm also interested in supporting those stations. I think their mission is important, so I'll try for my work to have some, you know, practical outcomes that they can use.
So I take it there are differences. What way are they using radio differently that makes this gap?
Yeah, so I think the first is the historical origins I mentioned. So the first station actually came on air in 1971. It was Wairu AM in North Carolina. They had a commercial license that they couldn't uphold. Just, it became too expensive. And the other station that came on air that same year, first non-commercial license, is KYUK in Alaska. And they're actually one of my project partners. So that is a station that I've visited. And so what changes how they operate, I think, is an awareness and still a belief very much in those values that started the station. They came on air very much straight out of Indigenous activism in the 70s, just a few weeks after the occupation of Alcatraz Island, actually, by Indigenous activists to raise more awareness. So there was a call for, you know, we need our own media, we need to bring our own voice out, we feel misrepresented in mainstream media, and that was a big motivation. So I think that is a first distinction. The other big thing, I think, is that there's a lack of access to other media and other sources. Even internet is lacking on tribal lands, so many people just don't have access to other forms of media, internet, mainstream sources, that type of thing. We have households with no electricity in the project sites where I've worked, and so radio is very accessible.
Are they rich in audio folklore, and does radio suit that?
Very much so. It's very oral cultures, so often their languages are not written, and the stations that I work with, and most of them, in fact, are bilingual in the Indigenous language and English, so they make a contribution to language revitalization. There is also musical folklore, of course. Many stations are committed to building audio archives, so they're broadcasting a lot of these, you know, very culturally ingrained, both, you know, talk, but also music, storytelling, what have you, and then also archiving these things for future generations to be used in tribal schools as educational materials. So,
is there a political dynamic to it? Are they struggling to get, you know, licenses to be on air as much as they need to be, or is there other struggles other than licenses that they have?
Yeah, so I think licensing is one. It often takes a long time, and their needs are very urgent. So often the delays can be an issue. As I mentioned, Wairu, the first station, wasn't able to uphold the commercial license that they had, so there can be issues around some of the requirements that even sometimes get attached to non-commercial licensing. And so, yes, I think there's issues around that. Also understanding a lot of the broadcasters or people who might want to start a station, tribes that are interested in having their own media, aren't adequately trained, or nobody is committed to providing the training to get the license that they need, to get it in time. All these types of things are lacking and sort of hard to access.
What has a German national got you interested in this topic?
Yes, very good question. I get that a lot. I think I've always had a more general interest from afar as somebody growing up in Germany, living here, not having very much direct interaction, and then sort of was meeting people early on by chance through interest who took me out there, introduced me to people, took me out on a reservation to the university, and got me sort of slowly more and more involved. So when I was doing my bachelor's, I had the chance to be a research assistant to a Hopi tribal member who also worked on research in our own community. So I was introduced that way, so that years and years later, you know, slowly developing relationships, I was able to, you know the people who would be interested in doing a project. So I would say it was as much, you know, their interest to work on a project on radio as it was mine, because we kind of already knew each other.
Is it greenfield research, or are you following in anyone's footsteps to do more deeper research into radio, or is this all new territory?
So there's very little prior work on tribal radio in the U.S. in particular. There's some in Canada that I can look at, and some people that I follow and try to sort of replicate in a different environment what they have done. But I would really like to go further, focus on the U.S. also because of the different legal environment. So you can't necessarily translate everything, of course, especially the issues we mentioned around licensing, I think, merits further study.
Is there anything that the wider radio or research communities can learn from the great things they're doing in reservations on radio?
I do think so. I think, or at least there could be, you know, mutual learning happening. I think it would go both ways, but many tribal stations operate, you know, with minimal resources in a very rural, remote environment where it's hard to, you know, get other experts out for people to travel to. So it's a very difficult environment, and they're making a really unique and important contribution. So I think they're doing phenomenal work with very, very little resources, which I think is true for many community broadcasters across the board. So I think if there's you know, some kind of forum or some sort of co-learning where people can share how they've solved different types of problems that they run into every day, that could potentially be beneficial.
Final question. Is there a really close relationship between listener and broadcaster because of the circumstances they find themselves in?
Yes, absolutely. So when I did my field work, I was, you know, present in the station for a longer period of time, and people would literally come by the station on foot to request something, to, you know, announce something on air, to ask a question, sort of using the radio station and the broadcasters and journalists as a source of information, and also just feeling culturally close. So there's really great respect for everybody working in radio because it is so needed and it's such a valued resource and it's very highly trusted. So I think people already feel close from a cultural standpoint. They have great respect for this kind of work and for the medium and recognize the importance. So I think there's that sort of closeness, but there's also actual closeness. People will show up at the station. They won't even just call in. They will go there and just try to, you know, be present and talk about whatever they wish to talk about. And the station's very open to that as well. So
Jana Wilbricht of the University of Michigan in the US, speaking about her research about community radio on Indigenous Native American reservations.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
There are plenty of changes afoot in the Dublin pirate radio scene, apparently on foot of an article in the Sunday Times recently, the Irish edition of the Sunday Times, which listed 14 stations in the capital, 13 on FM and Energy on AM. The number of stations on air certainly reduced in the weeks following the article, and recently many pirates have in fact moved across to the unlicensed DAB platform FreeDAB, which operates in both Dublin and Cork. FreeDAB have told the Radio Today website of their frustration with the process to get Section 71 content provision licences, which are needed for DAB. There is, of course, still no clear plan for DAB in Ireland. Galway and the North West aren't covered by the transmission network at all, and the sector remains entirely stagnant. Of course, we are former pirates ourselves on this programme and we understand why pirate radio would exist, but it seems to me that there are plenty of opportunities for experimentation in radio terms on the largely unused spectrum of DAB and indeed on the unused spectrum of AM as well, and there certainly is an opportunity there for far more freedom to experiment in the radio sector. So speaking of pirates, 2019 is full of radio anniversaries, which of course are linked to the close down of the pirates at the end of 1988, because of course 2019 is the 30th anniversary of the establishment of licensed independent radio. And this summer, 40 years of community radio Yawl in East Cork were celebrated. CRY began as a pirate on the 4th of July 1979. It's been licensed as a community station since 1995. And here's an extract from a recent documentary aired by CRY to mark its 40th anniversary.
It has been a real pleasure working as a pirate, even though we broke the law. But we've made the law as well, because we changed the law. Only for the likes of pirate radio, we wouldn't be anywhere where we are now.
Hello, I'm Justin Ma. I'm the programme director of Community Radio Yawl. Since 1995, our station has been a licensed community broadcaster serving Yawl Town and the surrounding rural areas. But this station started way before that. It goes all the way back to 1979, a time when the pirates ruled the airwaves, and a group of young men were inspired by the nation's broadcaster to join the club.
Pirate stations were being set up and, to an extent, ignored by the authorities. And while it might sound a bit Wild West and all that, we had no fear, so we just went for it.
It was a time when you couldn't buy a radio station, you had to build it.
Did you ever see any of those films with Dr. Frankenstein? He was going to his laboratory. You could hear the bzzz, bzzz. That's what it was like up there. There was jam pots and bits of wire going into bottles and clubs.
And these group of young men wanted to provide a voice to their community.
We wanted to rope in the entire town of all ages. Of all ages. And that was very important.
Today, we broadcast from purpose-built studios with office space and meeting rooms. But this station wasn't born in an office. It wasn't born in a studio. It was born in an upstairs attic.
An extract from a recent anniversary about 40 years of Community Radio Youghal. And we thank Dara Parker and Justin Marr for that audio. The programme was supported by the Sound and Vision Scheme of the BAI. That extract included the voice of Noel Cronin, one of the station's founders. So I caught up with Noel by phone from Youghal recently and asked him to tell us about his memory of the beginning of the station 40 years ago.
Hello, John, and indeed delighted to be on your programme. The launch of the station was actually initiated, John, by RTE. And now what RTE had done at the time is to, we said, to combat the onslaught of the pirates. They decided to put what's called a community radio station, a temporary community radio station, and travel around it from area to area. And they came to Youghal, and looked around for people, we'd say, that would be well got in the community, basically. And they had a kind of a public meeting as such. And they threw this idea, RTE themselves threw this idea out to the people, onto this public meeting, to say, look, we're going to bring a radio station here for a week. And things rested so, and they brought it for a week. Now, what they had, basically, was a small portable studio and a remote transmitter. And they broadcast it, we say, from the studio on VHF, and they had a remote transmitter then up in the hill in medium wave. And this went on for a week. And, of course, everybody participated in this for a week. It was a huge thing in the town for a week. But the trouble about it is, when it went, it left a void. And there was actually four of us got together and decided, look, well, would we chance a radio station? Now, I had experience of working with radio in the stations in Cork, in the pirate radio stations in Cork, such as Cork City Radio, Cork Broadcasting Company. There were pirate stations in Cork. And in the 70s, in 76, 77, I was working with them, building transmitters and doing maintenance for them at the time. So we got together and we decided to put a radio station on air here. Now, at the time, pirate radio was frowned upon by the authorities. It was a kind of an open secret. It was a kind of a thing that, everybody just, the law was bent and people took no notice of it and they were doing no harm,
Yeah.
Now, I think, in the Dublin and the Cork situation, the point about it, they were getting very, very big. You had stations like ARD in Dublin and you had Radio Dublin with huge transmitters that were transmitting practically halfway around the country and back into England, and there was pressure coming, we'd say, from the British Isles and from Europe as regards trying to alleviate these pirates, we said, from the interference point of view. But here, we said, the government at the time kind of took a view of it, look, they were doing no harm, and as long as they were small and basically not
not interfering.
Not interfering with anybody. It was a kind of, they were springing up. And basically, these stations were springing up all over the country. And RTE themselves were practically responsible, I suppose, even though it kind of backfired on them in a way, because they were responsible for setting up a lot of the small pirate stations, certainly here in Youghal and certainly in West Cork and certainly in Waterford and in Tipperary and in Kilkenny and Carlow and right up along the line, any small communities that they went to, because they did travel around the place with this, community radio station wagon,
And was it hard to drum up support locally then, or was the support already there thanks to RTE? Was it hard to get a schedule together and to get enough people to get a decent service on air?
Not really, because when we actually started this, we actually started for a run for fun. And I always say, look, that we started on the 4th of July 1979, and I went in there just for a weekend or for a week just to see how it would go. And we were no sooner on the air, and the community embraced us. There was people coming to us, look, I'd like to do something here, I'd like to do something there, you know. We started getting community notices. We got a notification from the local council that, you know, would we broadcast council meetings, that kind of thing, you know. You know, we got huge support. The Gardaí were coming to us with, you know, road closures, etc., that kind of thing, you see. So very early on, you know, and we were absolutely amazed with this, like. You know?
Yeah, you had a couple of interesting references in the documentary. We heard an extract from it earlier about politicians gradually becoming more involved in the station, starting with councillors and then eventually TDs. There was a little bit of worry, I suppose, on the part of elected representatives to be seen to be endorsing pirate radio. But once they realised that it was important and that it mattered and that it had meaning and power, they started to get involved.
Oh, of course, because it provided a local platform for any local TD that was running for a council or whatever the case may be. It provided a local platform, and they wouldn't get that local platform anywhere in the country. You see, so, you know, they embraced this, you know, and they really came on board with it. And they had no scruples about these pirate stations being illegal. And I think that was repeated all over the country, John, you know.
I think there were cases in other situations where some politicians were disciplined for going on air and things by their party headquarters, but I don't think that applied in your case from what you say.
Not really. No, we never heard of anybody, any politician being disciplined. And I suppose if they were disciplined, they just got a rap on the knuckle and said, look, don't do it again kind of thing, or whatever the case may be. But basically, you know, it wasn't open secret where these stations were located. And as I say, that's the politicians, especially the local politicians, that were running for the local councils, which were involved at the time, they really took it on board, you know.
You mentioned earlier on the Gardaí giving you local notices. Were you ever actually raided by the Gardaí, as many pirate stations were?
No, and I tell you, I think the real reason was, you see, up to the time we came on the air on the 4th of July, 1979, but up to that, a lot of the stations, 90% of the stations right around the country, were just basically playing wall-to-wall music, you know, and they were catering with, in the big towns or big cities. But we were one of the first, which are rural stations. We were appealing to a rural community, you see. Now, in a way, I suppose, we're kind of in the border between Cork and Waterford, so we appeal to both rural communities. And what we found, that the rural communities really embraced the idea of local radio, you know. And again, I suppose, at the time, and even it still prevails today, John, that local radio is all about identification, or community radio is all about identification, because we've seen it of late now, we said the demise of the local post offices, and so much has been taken out of the rural community that, you know, the rural community has the local station to fall back in. And again, they can identify with what the presenter is talking about, and you'll probably find the same thing yourself up there, you know.
And you had a number of flagship programmes that, again, are mentioned in the documentary, programmes that were kind of early outside broadcasts and sitting in people's kitchens, doing recordings in housing estates around Youghal and going to pubs in the general West Waterford and East Cork area. Can you tell us about some of those highlights in the early years of the pirate station?
Well, one of the programmes, as you mentioned there, one of the programmes was a presenter, we say, taking a small Moran's tape recorder out to, we say, local estates. Now, what he would do is he'd go to one of the local estates maybe a couple of days beforehand, and he'd talk to maybe somebody living in the estate and said, look, if it's all right, we'd like to do a programme from your place. I'd like to do a programme from your place. If you can gather a couple of the neighbours around the place, we'll just go into the kitchen, sit down, have a cup of tea, very relaxed, informative atmosphere, and go down, sit down, and talk to the residents, we say, in the estates about their problems, their unemployment problems, you know, council infrastructure in the estate, that kind of thing, you know, and unemployment and, you know, work-related issues. And he was mostly talking to housewives, was in the estates. Now, this was a groundbreaking programme, because it basically brought radio, not alone, we said, to the small towns like Youghal, but it brought radio into the estates itself. And it gave people in the estates a voice. They would never have a voice otherwise, you know. This was one of the programmes, and I think it was a programme that was way, way ahead of its time. This was being done now in 1979, 1980 by our presenters here, you know. The other programme you mentioned, actually, was a Pair and Neutron Tour. Now, the name of it actually was Pavel Cahy was one of the presenters, and there was a chap here called Kennefic, and his name was Newt Kennefic, and he was a bit of a character.
That's a strange name. Was that a nickname?
That was a nickname.
Yeah.
You know that was actually his nickname. William Kennefic was his name, but nobody knew him as William, and he was actually a retired fisherman. But he had the gift of the gab, and he had a wonderful personality, and he was from the town. He knew everybody in the town. Now, the whole idea of the programme was that if you were bringing somebody into a studio with lights and with, say, microphones and screens and the whole lot in front of them like we do now, people would feel very, very intimidated by that.
Yes, of course.
So his idea was to bring the radio out to the local guy in the pub. He's sitting down there, he has maybe a pint in front of him, or whatever the case may be, and he's sitting down among his friends, and he'll talk for Ireland, and he'll relay all the stories and the history of the whole lot. And again, we would go out to this particular, we'd say, public house, and we would talk to the publican maybe a week before and say, look, will you line up six of your best guests on the programme? And we will call on a Monday night, because it was always done on a Monday night when the pubs were fairly slack.
Okay.
You know? And we go in on a Monday night and we record that. Now, the equipment we had actually was very minimal. All we had is a public address amplifier, tape recorder, two loudspeakers, two microphones, and off we'd go. But a funny thing, actually, a lot of the publicans thought, because radio at the time, a lot of people, I suppose, didn't know the value of community radio. They didn't know the value, we'd say, of local radio at all. So a lot of the publicans thought that when we'd walk in with this gear, they'd say, is that all you have? Where are the lights? Where are the cameras? Where's all this kind of thing, you know? But there were some wonderful programmes recorded on that, and some wonderful anecdotes of people that are now well gone. But this programme, it had run for about maybe 2 to 3 years, and we did all the pubs in East Cork and West Waterford. Now, I think nowadays, looking at it actually, it's very unlikely that that could be repeated, I suppose, with the drink driving laws and the whole lot, and you wouldn't get that. But a lot of the time, actually, the pubs used to be packed for the programme. And then, again, the programme used to go out on a Wednesday, and it used to be about roughly an hour and a half long. But the programme used to go out on a Wednesday, and the pub would be packed for the Wednesday, and the whole programme itself would go out Sunday at 12 o'clock, and the pub would be packed again, you know?
Okay, so they'd be packing into the pubs to listen to it as
well?
They'd
be packing into the pubs. Okay. At one stage, actually, you know, the public, in some cases, the public had to issue tickets and say, look, okay, pre-book your seat.
Right, just to listen to the show,
to see the lads in operation, like.
Yeah.
Because, as I say, it was bringing radio, it was shattering the myth of radio and the technical side of radio. It was bringing the radio right into the people's, we say, domain themselves, you know.
And you mentioned how simple the technical setup was for recording. What was the transmission setup like? Presumably you were medium wave only in the early years before going on to FM as well, or did you ever have FM as well as medium wave?
No, what we did actually, we started off with medium wave. We started off in 202 metres medium wave. What we used to have actually at night time, a funny thing, actually, at night time, we just change our frequency to 199 metres. And the reason being is we used to do nighttime programmes from around maybe 11 o'clock until about maybe 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Now, this is back in the pirate days now. And we just change frequency for those. The reason being is that on a frequency of 199 metres, there was a station in North Africa, Jeddah, and that just broadcast. I think it was something like 3 or 4 megawatts right around Europe and practically half around the world on 199 metres. But for some peculiar reason, this station used to close down, turn off the transmitter at 11 o'clock and resume it at 3 o'clock. And we cottoned onto the idea that if we started transmitting on 199 metres at 11 o'clock at night, that we had a free band practically all over the world, and we would get... hopefully we will get saturation of far-flung places. Now, what we did this, the first couple of weeks we did it, we started to get letters from all over the world, DXers, you know, anoraks, radio anoraks, for want of a better word, that we said they would be listening out for these stations. And we started to get hundreds of letters from all over the world.
How far away were they coming from?
They were coming from Russia, they were coming from Buenos Aires, they were coming from Australia, they were coming from all over the world.
And what power were you putting into the transmitter?
All we were putting out at the time, it was 25 watts. At the time, on the winter's evening, around maybe November, October, November, December, the sporadic E level was very, very high, and it would reflect the signal practically all over the world. It was a hit-and-miss affair, basically, you know. But you would transmit practically all over the world on a very low frequency.
And your 202 metres, then, your main transmitter, was that just for daytime, then?
For daytime.
And how far would you be getting that signal?
When we started off, of course, like, renovating was ongoing. Like, we started off with a power of 25 watts, then we increased up to 50 watts, then we increased up to 150 watts, and then we decided to purchase an old ex-BBC transmitter from the north, you know, a 1 kilowatt transmitter. Now, we couldn't run it as a kilowatt, obviously, but we ran it at about maybe 600 or 700 watts, you know. Now, again, as it was, like, the aerials we had were completely, at the time, like, everything was homemade. The aerials were completely inefficient. I reckon if we had the right aerial, we'd probably cover half the south of Ireland with it, you know?
Yeah.
But at the time, we covered into Middleton, and we covered down to Dungarvan, and covered a bit, 18, 19 miles, that kind of thing, you know?
So your main listenership area went right into West Waterford and up as far as towns like Middleton and Cork, as you say.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, as I say, Middleton, you know, a radius of about 18, 19 miles, that kind of thing, you know.
Okay. And to come then to the closure of CRY, Noel, on the 31st of December 1988, we've covered this date many times on this programme before, a landmark day in Irish radio history. Can you tell us about your memories of the close down of the pirate CRY and how you felt on that night?
Well, it was a very emotional night for us. Because we were after moving from our premises, when we started up in an attic above by the Godfings and High part of the town here in Eileen Connolly's farmhouse. We started off there, and we were about maybe 2 to 3 years there, I'd say, when we got the idea to move down into the main street. Now, when we moved down into the main street, we had a small 5-watt VHF transmitter, you see, and we transmitted that then up into the Godfings. So we kept the medium wave on the Godfings. We were also around the town on, we say, 4 or 5 watts FM. Now, again, we were in town at the time, and I said, when the date came, and of course it was well publicised, the 31st of December 1988, that a lot of the pirates would voluntarily go off the air, and if they didn't, they had stood no chance of a licence. So we said, look, we will go off the air. And it was a very emotional night for us, because at that stage we were part of the community, we were firmly ensconced in the community, and I remember a couple of days afterwards, like, it was like a death in the town, since 1979 the town had a voice, and East Cork and West Waterford had a voice. No, they hadn't, you know, and to the old story, you'll never miss the water till the well run dry. We were on the inside looking out. We were on the inside of the radio looking out. But we didn't realise the power we had, or we didn't realise what it meant to people until we actually went off the air.
You probably didn't think that it would take so long for the community radio licensing process to happen.
We didn't, you see. And the point about it, like, is to be quite fair to the BAA, the IRTC at the time, when they were set up, they advertised the franchises. And to tell you the truth, like, is they actually went on a fact-finding course to America and to Australia, and the Australians and the Americans told them in no uncertain terms that anything under 7 million people, you wouldn't, it wasn't worth broadcasting to, you know. That was the response that they got back, like, but they were scratching their heads saying, look, we have to fulfil a need, we have to serve the county stations. Of course, then they started up, they started Sanctuary Radio, and surprise, surprise, Sanctuary Radio went belly up in them, you know. And then they looked, the rest of the stations then, like, we'd say, Cork and Waterford and regional stations, they were bringing on county stations then, and they were allowing franchises for them, you see, to come through. But the community section was very, very far down on their list, very, very far down. And they didn't really, to tell you the truth, they didn't know And to be quite honest, to be quite fair to them, they weren't aware, basically, of the huge input that community radio would have. And after a while, when they did get their act together, when they did start looking at it in 1993, 1994, they did start looking at community radio, and they said, okay, and they appointed a liaison officer there for community radio there. Ciarán Cassan was appointed. And I have to say, Ciarán was a godsend to him, because Ciarán worked at the pirate radio in Dublin, and he had an idea of, we'd say, basically what community radio was. So they advertised six franchises around the country at the time, and we were one of the lucky ones, actually, to get a licence in 1995, you know.
And do you think, did that gap of 6 years, Noel, did you lose a lot of the momentum in terms of the people who were interested in radio in the town? It was a very long time to have no radio station after such a long history of radio in Youghal.
Well, I think we did lose people. We did lose a certain amount of people. But I'm delighted to say a lot of the people, 75% of the people came back to us again, you know. You know, they actually came back, and they never lost it. They never lost the idea of, or never lost the love of broadcasting. And more 75% of them came back, you know. But a funny thing, what we did find actually, that in the intervening years, that the concept of radio had changed from, we'd say, the pirate days to, we'd say, the start of the licensing to start in 1995. I had found that the concept of radio had completely changed. Naturally, technology had moved on. There were so many things that have actually happened, and people's tastes changed as well. So what we did find was that we were gone from being basically, I suppose, a town station. And when I say predominantly in the town, we were gone from kind of a station that was predominantly in the town to a much wider field. And we found that the idea, and we basically found that people, when we came back in 1995, people embraced the idea of it, you know. So it was, and you're right, it was a fair transition period between 1988 and 1995, you know.
And how would you compare, just to finish up, Noel, how would you compare the current station in Youghal, the current CRY, with the pirate years, with the pirate station?
Well, basically, I suppose back in the pirate days, look, for a case of, look, to be quite honest, it was baling twine and barbed wire that kept the whole lot together. Nowadays, it's completely different, you know. Technology has come on, and as we all know, in leaps and bounds. And, you know, what we had to cobble together years ago with television valves and bits of coils of wire and this, that, and the other thing, and everything was homemade in the pirate days. Nowadays, it's so sophisticated as all the equipment will practically talk to you, you know. And as well as that, the programmes are after getting more sophisticated because, as I say, people's tastes out there, people's tastes are becoming more sophisticated as well, you know.
That was Noel Cronin, one of the founders of Community Radio Youghal, speaking about the station's 40 years on air. And you can listen live to CRY on CRY104FM.com.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
Another radio anniversary recently was the 25 years of the morning show on East Coast Radio in Wicklow, presented by Declan Meehan, one of Ireland's most experienced broadcasters. And we send Declan our very best wishes, and we hope that he will have many more happy years on radio. I recently interviewed Declan as part of our online Irish Pirate Radio audio archive at pirate.ie. And here's an extract from that interview.
This was 82, yeah, and this was July. So I had an appointment to see Chris, and that was intercepted by Andy Archer, who had joined. And Andy Archer was one of my heroes from Radio Caroline, Radio North Sea, Radio everything on pirate ships during the 1970s. And here was Andy Archer, and he wants to meet me. So we met in the Henry Grattan, and I was doing afternoons on Sunshine and thing. Nice to slot in the afternoons. And he says, first things first. He says, the job is there. Chris wants you on the air, as you know. And I said, great. And what's the time slot? He was thinking, oh, what is it, 2 to 7 or is it 3 to 7 or what is it? He says, it's breakfast. I said, breakfast? He said, I've had a very bad experience, Andy, on breakfast. I just, the 2FM thing left its indelible mark. I just don't want to do this anymore. He says, well, that's the gig. And he says, you'll enjoy Nova. He says, it'd be different. So I always listen to being reassured. So went off with girlfriend Sive at the time, and we went to play pool in the Swan Centre, just across the road from that in Rathmines, and we stayed there till the end discussing whether I should go to Radio Nova or not. And I mean, the answer was always, I'm going to Radio Nova. So it was breakfast then. So met with Andy again, and then went back to Herbert Street in Chris was there. And Chris says, well, what are we doing? And Andy says, he's joined doing breakfast. He says, right, good, okay. I said, well, when do I start? Oh, not for a while. He says, you've got to wash that sunshine out of you. And I said, okay, and what does that mean? He says, I've got a condominium in Orange County, MacArthur Avenue or some place, in Santa Ana. And he says, you're going over there. He says, you've got a girlfriend? I said, yeah. He says, yeah, two of you go over there. He says, but it's not a holiday. What is it? He says, there's a station over there called Kiss FM. You'll find a radio in the condominium. And basically, you listen to it all the time. And he says, you can sit out in the sun in the afternoon in the jacuzzi, but have that radio beside you. He says, and there's a car as well for you to drive around. So we had a great time listening to Kiss FM driving around Los Angeles. And the whole thing was to pick up the sort of feeling of the radio station. And it was, they now call it yacht music that was being played, which was Michael McDonald, Steely Dan, Robbie Dupree, Hall & Oates, all that sound, Fleetwood Mac, and they were all great sounds, and the rhythm and the way the jocks, which I loved, which the 60s DJs had, of integrating their announcements with the songs. You would talk faster during a fast record and then slow down to play a nice little ballad. There was nowadays it's presenting, you know, and here is Hall & Oates. But in those days it was, you know, ingratiating yourself with the listener into the song. You were part of the song. It was great. But anyway, I learned sort of those particular things and enjoyed Kiss FM, enjoyed the holiday. And then he starts sending everybody over, because he thought it was a great idea, which was, and I was there twice, over to Los Angeles. So we got the idea.
But he sent others over as well, so that all of the presenters would be acquainted with the sound.
That's right, and over, and everything was paid for. You know,
he explains a lot of why the Nova sound was the way it was basically.
Declan Meehan now of East Coast Radio in Wicklow, speaking recently to the Irish Pirate Radio Audio Archive, and you can listen to that interview in full at pirate.ie. And that brings us to the end of this month's packed edition of Wireless on Flirt FM. Join us again on the first Monday in November for more radio news and features from home and abroad, including more from the Conference of the European Communication Research and Education Association in Italy, and also for a report on the forthcoming CRAIL Fela of community radio in Dublin. I hope you'll join us then, but in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt and on facebook.com/wirelessflirt. You can also listen to previous shows on wirelessflirt.radio.ie, where you can subscribe to our new podcast. We're now available on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, Castbox, Player.fm, Podcast Addict, and Acast. Until the next edition of Wireless, this is John Walsh wishing you good listening.